working. His body's too young to look like his. My mama went off and left him.
All right, welcome back. I'm Lawrence Brown sitting in for Mark Steiner. You're listening to WEAA on the campus of the Mighty Morgan State University. WEAA 88.9, the voice of the community. And that was Fast Car by Tracy Chapman, who was born this date in 1964. And right now in our last segment, we're have on the phone with us Dee Dee Guttenplan, who's the London correspondent for The Nation, the magazine, and he's also the co-editor of the nation's 150th anniversary issue. Mr. Guttenplan, welcome to the Mark Steiner Show.
Dr. Brown, a pleasure to be here. Thank you for having me.
Absolutely, and I want you to tell me a little bit about this issue. I had a chance to check out a couple of the pieces that are in there. I was really drawn to a lot of the articles that were in the Radical Futures section of this, and there was also, especially the one about Haiti, about making college tuition free. I was really excited to read that one as a person who's saddled with over $100,000 in student loans. And so what was this 150th issue all about?
Sure. Well, you know, The Nation is the oldest weekly magazine in the country. It was founded, the first issue came out in July 1865. It was founded by abolitionists, who essentially were the successors to The Liberator, William Lloyd Garrison's
right.
great magazine.
Mm-hmm.
And, in fact, William Lloyd Garrison's son-in-law, his son, Wendell Phillips Garrison, was the first literary editor of the magazine.
Wow.
So what happened is we decided we wanted to celebrate in a number of ways. There's a movie that's just come out called Hot Type, a documentary by Barbara Koppel. I've written a History of the Nation magazine, which will be out in April as an ebook. But in the meanwhile, there's this 150th anniversary special issue, and I suppose the shortest way to describe it is fat.
It is. It's really thick.
You know, any of your readers any of your listeners who read The Nation will know that we are not normally confused with Vogue or Vanity Fair.
Right.
but this is a 268-page bumper issue, so it's got a lot in it, and I'm very pleased to hear that you were drawn to the Radical Futures part, because in a way, I mean, I come to this as a historian. That's my other hat, and that's why they asked me to write the history of the magazine. So we have a lot of archival material in this issue from each of the 15 decades The Nation's been publishing. But, you know, we are an ongoing magazine with an ongoing project, and we really wanted the issue to lean forward, to face the future. So that's why there is this whole section on Radical Futures. And I suppose the other thing I can say about both the magazine and this issue is that it's a good place to go for an argument.
Yes.
Because, you know, it may be that the right in America has unanimity, that they know exactly what they want, which is to dismantle the government. but we on the left have always debated what we want to do, and out of those debates have arisen some of our best ideas. And so The Nation has always seen itself as an extremely important forum for those debates. And in a way, that's what the Radical Futures section of this issue is. It's a series of ideas about how to go forward. They're not all equally compatible with each other, but they are all, I hope, equally interesting.
Absolutely. And as a person who's been at this historical institution that is The Nation, what are some of the things that you're most proud of in this issue that you see that people really maybe should hone in on?
Well, I think there's lots of things. I mean, I think one of the essays that I like the best and that I had the most fun working on is by a young man called Touré.
Oh, yes.
Who's an MSNBC person and a writer himself,
mm-hmm.
Author of books. But what we did is we asked him to engage with Langston Hughes's great article from the 1920s, The Negro Artist and the Racial Mountain. And in the 1920s, there was essentially a controversy which took place again in The Nation's pages. And it was one of the things that struck me most in researching the history is how much The Nation served as a venue for African Americans to argue among themselves with very little regard to the fact that most of the magazine's readers were then and still are white. But nonetheless, the fact that the magazine opened its pages And these arguments took place, and they were extremely impassioned arguments. And what Langston Hughes was doing was basically making the case for what we would later call African-American studies and a black power movement and an independent African-American culture.
Right.
And he said it's clearly part of American culture. American culture derives from it, but nonetheless it needs to stand on its own 2 feet, and its artists and writers need to take pride in who they are and not look at white models.
Powerful, very, very powerful. How long have you been an editor at The Nation?
Well, I'm not an editor at The Nation. I'm a correspondent. I've been in the London Bureau for 17 years now. But I was a Nation intern in 1979, so I've been connected with the magazine and writing for it in one way or another for a long time.
Amazing. I also really like the piece James Baldwin wrote that was from 1966, a report from occupied territory talking about the police. I was thinking, you know, not a lot has really changed.
Well, you know, I mean, it's interesting. One of our younger contributors, Michael Denzel Smith, said he was infuriated by that piece, not because he was angry at James Baldwin, but mm-hmm. because in the piece he came across not just the concept, but the phrase stop and frisk. And this was 1966.
Yes.
And Baldwin's writing about the license that this gives the police, you know, in Harlem to just go up and stop people and how it feels to be on the receiving end of that. And that's why he calls it occupied territory. I mean, he was writing about, in a sense, the militarization of policing, something that we've been seeing too much of in recent years, back in 1966.
Well, Don, I just want to thank you so much for coming to the Mark Steiner Show. I know this conversation is all too brief. Hopefully, we can bring you back at some point to talk about your work and what The Nation has been contributing a little bit more. Any final thoughts?
Well, my final thought is that I think people should take, well, yes, very important to note that this whole issue is available for free download on our website. So if you go to www.thenation.com, you can take a look at it for nothing. You can download it for nothing. Now, the reason we can do that is because we think it's a beautiful object that you will, once you read it, you will want to have it in your hands.
Mm.
But in any case, please do take a look.
Thank you so much, Don Didi Guttenplan. Ladies and gentlemen, thank you so much for joining us from all the way from London, England. Thank you so much.
It's been great being with you. Thanks very much. Take care.
Absolutely. And once Bye-bye. Again, this is Lawrence Brown sitting in for Mark Steiner. The Mark Steiner Show is a production of the Center for Emerging Media. And our captains of the mothership, the producers are Stephanie Mavronis and my man Mark Gonnery. And then, of course, the captain of the mothership is our engineer, Andre Melton. Thank you. I appreciate your help. Our engineering intern is Anthony Nichols. Our intern and day in history research producer is Sienna Greaves. Our theme music is by Wall Matthews of Clean Cuts. And on our way out of here, we're hearing Too Legit to Quit. Y'all know that's Too Legit to Quit by MC Hammer, who was born on this day in 1962. Too Legit to Quit, MC Hammer. To podcast the Mark Steiner Show and share it with your friends, visit us on the web at steinershow.org or listen to us on your favorite podcasting app. Once again, so happy to be with you today. And remember, as you go, Baltimore, everybody's got a little light under the sun. Flashlight. This is Lawrence Brown. Have a great day.